Tarek has written widely on Pakistan, for where he's from, and on the subcontinent politically. But of course, most recently, a series of very major works on the central problem of today, revolution and counter-revolution and American imperialism, clash of fundamentalisms, sort of one of the first and most influential books in response to the Bush adventure. Then Bush in Babylon, I don't know how he thinks of these great titles. And most recently and relevant today, most relevant for a talk today, Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope. And that's what Tarek is going to be talking to us about today. And thanks a lot, Tarek.
Thanks very much, Bob, for those kind words. Let me start off by what sort of revived my interest in Latin America. It was, to put it very bluntly, the events in Venezuela at the turn of the century. And some Latin Americanists in Britain who follow Latin America very closely said to me, one of them in particular, Richard Gott, that what is happening in Venezuela is something very different. This is no ordinary guy. And it's something that should be followed and watched. And subsequently, from 2000 till now, I've made about 7 visits, trips to Venezuela, interviewed Chavez on each occasion, had discussions, conversations with him. So I feel fairly knowledgeable about this particular project that is taking place. And this was, you know, at a time long before he started making speeches at the United Nations General Assembly. This was as when he began to change Venezuela. Now, so what I want to do today is give you an account of this and what impact this has had on the Latin American continent as a whole. Because that, I think, is extremely important. Now, the Bolivarian Project, as they call it, what is it? It's basically a fairly straightforward project, which is to challenge the neoliberal order, to challenge the Washington Consensus, to challenge U.S. hegemony in Latin America, and to try and create a social alternative. What is this social alternative? It is not a revolution like the Cuban Revolution or the other revolutions of the 20th century, and they're very specific about that. It is essentially, I guess, the most useful way to describe it would be a process of structural social reforms to shift the relationship of forces in Venezuela away from the oligarchy on the side of the deprived and underprivileged classes in that country. That is what this project is, and that is why this project has created total mayhem in the whole of Latin America, because no other political leader did it. What are the features of this project? First, that Chavez, we will discuss the others a bit later, came to power through democratic elections. The 6th of these elections is about to be contested. Every time he has won the election, and with increasing majorities, the latest opinion polls in Venezuela show him between 65 and 70%. Now, that is something which challenges the dominant ideology, which assumes, I mean the ideology of the neoliberal world and the Washington Consensus, which assumes these days that the only function of democracy is to produce politicians and political parties who come to power determined to defend this consensus. And in Latin America, they are using democracy to actually challenge this consensus. So when they do that, then democracy itself comes under attack. And in Venezuela, they did it successfully. This was a country where the poor never used to vote, not totally unlike the United States in that regard. But the poor started voting when they saw that there was a leadership emerging which was going to do something for them. And the origins of this go back to an event which is very little talked about, but which I describe in some detail in the book. I'll only give it, you know, just mention it in passing, because without understanding that, you don't understand what triggered off the change. It was in 1989. You know, many people think that the first giant revolt against the corporations and neoliberalism came in Seattle. Well, that was an important event, but in 1989 there was already a semi-insurrection in parts of Venezuela against the IMF and the measures that they had proposed to the Social Democratic government to push through. And these measures were pushed through, and the poor and the working class rose in revolt against them. And this revolt spread from Caracas to neighboring areas. So within 2 days, you had tens and tens of thousands of people saying, we will not accept these measures. And as the revolt grew in size, Carlos Andrés Pérez, the social democratic president of Venezuela, a leading light of the Socialist International, decided to call in the army, and they opened fire. And between 2,000 to 3,000 people were killed. That was the first revolt against neoliberalism in Latin America and indeed the globe. Between 2,000 to 3,000 people were killed, and that set off a chain reaction. Inside the army itself, we now know, we have all the facts, and some of them are in the appendices, interviews with military officers who say Chavez began to agitate and said, this is not what the army is for. The army is to defend our country, not to kill our people. And they began to organize. Meetings of military, junior military officers, they were all junior officers, began to take place. And when Carlos Andrés Pérez, the president, was surprised at the officer call, the junior officers are very upset. He said, what are their ranks? And when told they were captains and majors, he said, never mind, by the time they become generals, we'll buy them over. But these guys could not be bought, basically. And in 92, they started, in 90 to 91, they started discussing with trade union activists, with political groups in the country, and said, we need to have an insurrection to topple, get rid of this oligarchy. That was the Chavez rebellion of 92, which failed because it was not well organized. He then did something which is unheard of. He went on public television. He was arrested and said, I need to speak to the people. And for some amazing reason, they allowed him. And he said, this was a mistake. I'm sorry. We were not prepared. It's my fault, and I accept full responsibility for it. No one in Venezuelan history had ever accepted responsibility for anything. That had a mega impact on the country. People said, this guy has made a mistake. He's come and told us it's a mistake. He's accepted full responsibility for it. And he was locked up. On his release, we now know this, and I've sort of reconstructed this in the book. He was invited to give a talk in Havana on Simon Bolivar. So he told me on one interview I had, he said, I was just a young officer, and I arrived at Havana airport, and to my astonishment, I was met by a very familiar bearded figure, who then took me to the university, and I gave my talk, and very serious questions were asked. What Chavez didn't know is that the Cubans were assessing him, trying to see what he was made of, what was the timber. And they were impressed, there's no doubt about that, at his knowledge, at his ability, at the way in which he responded to questions, etc. So when he contested the elections in 98-99, the response of the people was immediate. They wanted to get rid of the oligarchic parties, which had ruled the country for some time, and try something else. They were just not going to return those parties which had ordered the killings. And that was Chavez's first victory. And he proceeded carefully and slowly. Because all the advice he got, we don't need to do anything in a rush. We don't want another Salvador Allende in this continent. You have to proceed slowly and make sure the people are on your side. And he did this. And essentially what has been happening in Venezuela is a set, we can characterize them as left social democratic reforms, which are very important for that country and which are changing the face of that country, albeit slowly. There are lots of problems as well which should not be underestimated and which I'll come to later. But for this one act of challenging the agreed consensus agreed by all the big powers in the world, and the bulk of the world, the Washington consensus, this was not to be tolerated. And the reason it was not to be tolerated was because it showed that it was possible to do something differently. That was the major reason. It's not that what was happening in Venezuela challenged native capital. The property of the oligarchs has not been touched. The private television networks have not been touched. All that is in place. But the use of the state and use in particular of the oil wealth to try and improve the living conditions of the poor, this was something which was not permissible under the new order. It was permissible after the Second World War and even to a certain extent before the Second World War. And people sometimes in the United States get very shocked when I describe it as such, especially those who have very little knowledge of what is going on in Venezuela. But what is going on, I would say, is a combination of the post-war reforms which took place in the bulk of Western Europe and the New Deal. That is what it is a combination of. It hasn't gone beyond that, the process. It may not. We don't know. We will have to see. A lot will depend on what happens elsewhere in Latin America. But in order to stop this happening, they made two big attempts to topple him. One was through a coup d'etat, which is quite an astonishing event in recent, even for Latin American history. In 2002, while they were already discussing how to organize regime change in Iraq, they were busy organizing regime change in Venezuela. Two totally different parts of the world. Iraq, a dictatorship under an authoritarian, though secular, leader. Venezuela, an elected government, democratically elected, but with a leadership which did not agree with the United States. And they operated in not a dissimilar way, though Iraq, of course, was occupied. But they tried to organize a coup d'etat in Venezuela. This was not just a plan of the United States. This was supported by the European Union. The Spanish were very heavily involved in it. The entire European Union was aware of it. And the IMF had allocated $35 billion to push into Venezuela if the coup succeeded. $3 billion were released on the day of the coup itself. Now, who was behind the coup? We know. The Washington Consensus. They were behind the coup. Internally, they had lined up a whole set of generals. The candidate they picked was unfortunate. He was a sort of third-rate corrupt businessman who got so excited when he was told that he was going to be president that he flew to Madrid and got himself measured for a presidential sash in a Madrid tailor's job, and came back already and willing to be president. Where some of the organization of the coup took place, apart from the military barracks, was in the headquarters of Gustavo Cisneros' television network. He's the Rupert Murdoch of Latin America, owns a large part of the private television networks on that continent, and they were getting ready to topple him. Television played an absolutely central part in the coup attempt, but it failed. The coup attempt failed. Why did it fail? It failed essentially because they made lots of mistakes, the coup leaders. They didn't know what to do with Chavez. They were too scared to kill him. One of the plans was that he might be disappeared somehow or sent to another country, as was later done with Aristide in Haiti, and foreign ships and planes were hovering around the place where Chavez was kept in captivity. But basically, what took them all by surprise was the support, the popular support, which began to show itself both inside the army and amongst the poor. The poor came down from the slums and began to march onto the Miraflores Palace, and inside the army, ordinary soldiers said, "We are not going to tolerate this." They said to their officers, "If you back this coup, you will have a mutiny on your hands." And the combination of these two things changed it around. Now, there's one very graphic episode which describes this. It's both a moving and quite a funny episode, that when they had this businessman and the presidential sash put on him, and he was about to be sworn in as president, the entire world's media was waiting outside for him to be brought outside. And the general behind the coup came outside and told the band, which plays the national anthem or just a quick march on official occasions, "When I bring the new president out," he said to these soldiers, "you will do what you do when Hugo Chavez used to come out. You will play the bugle." He said to the bugler, "You will play the band." And the band leader said to him, "Excuse us, general, what new president? Because we elected another president, so what is going on?" And the general said, "You will obey orders." Three times the band leader said to him, "What new president? Who elected him?" And this legitimacy, democratic legitimacy of the regime, was to prove to be extremely important in mass mobilizations. Finally, the general got fed up talking to the band leader and turned to a 17-year-old soldier who played the bugle. And he said to this soldier, "You will play the bugle when I bring the new president out." And the bugler said, "General, excuse me, but which president are you going to bring out?" And this, the general, when the 17-year-old peasant kid, raw recruit, says this, lost his temper, and he said, "You are here to obey orders." And the 17-year-old bugler said to the general, "General, you seem to be very keen that someone plays the bugle when your new president comes out. Here, you play it." Now, what is interesting about that? I mean, it's funny, but the thing which struck me when I heard about that was, what gives a kid the courage, the political courage, to say this to a serving general inside an army which has been totally hierarchical? Totally hierarchical. What gives him the courage is the rising political consciousness as a result of the changes that are being seen, and an identification with a process which the poor, and most of the soldiers come from very poor families, they know with all its weaknesses, however slow, it's on our side. This is the first government we've had for a long, long time which is on our side. That is what gives him the courage, and that is what meant that within 48 hours, and there's an amazing documentary made by some Irish filmmakers called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, who happened to be in the palace when all this was going on, and they actually film these guys running as the soldiers march into the palace, you know, trying to find out where they are, and then all the scenes which show Chavez returning to, you know, with hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets. The coup backfired very badly. The second attempt to get rid of this regime was a classic attempt using similar mechanisms that had been used to topple Salvador Allende in Chile, and which had succeeded on September the 11th, 1973. This was a big build-up which led to Allende's overthrow by organizing some of the unions, right-wing unions, collaborating with the right-wing parties in Chile. Here, they organized a strike of the Oil Workers Union, which was totally linked into the corrupt political party structure. They came out on strike. Then the middle-class sectors were brought out on strike, doctors and teachers. And I remember after this was all over, I said to Chavez, of these two events, the military coup and the strike, which did you fear the most? And he said, "I knew the coup makers would not get away with it because I knew our people, both inside the and outside the army." He said the strike worried me because he said the coup, after all, affected me. They could kill me, whatever. But the strike's aim was to totally create chaos and destabilize the whole country. And I was worried because he said, you know, people are depend on all these facilities. The breweries went on strike. People said that the kids who drink beer in these slums will join the rebellion. That was the aim, to trigger off a situation where people marched against them. That backfired. That backfired for two reasons. One, the people in the slums, etc., said to him, "If you fight on," there's an incident I describe, I don't want to repeat a lot of stuff in the book, where Chavez said he got so much support from poor people who said, "Don't give up now, don't let them screw you." And he said kids sort of, you know, in gangs used to come up and said, "We can do without our beer for a long time, but you don't let these guys defeat us." So that support gave him a lot of hope. And then he said what was absolutely decisive. He said, "I rang Fidel and I said, we're in trouble and this is what's going on and we need some help." And he said within 2 weeks, the Cubans had sent 14,500 doctors, medicines, camp hospitals, and in the poorest areas of Venezuela, where there had never been even a clinic, they set up all these things. I mean, the poor used to have to go to middle-class neighborhoods to see a doctor. They said the whole thing was turned upside down. The doctors had gone on strike, and the hospitals were not functioning. The Cubans came up and set these hospitals all over the country. The oligarchy made a very big mistake when they said, "These are not doctors, these guys coming, guys and women coming in white coats. These are actually terrorists." who are being infiltrated into Venezuela to wage a guerrilla warfare like they did in the 60s and 70s, and be very careful. But this entire campaign backfired when even the supporters of the oligarchy in the poor neighborhood saw what was happening. People were getting free medical treatment. Similar process happened with the teachers. So here you saw a very interesting process where this tiny island of 12 million people in the Caribbean with many problems, many, many problems, serious problems, but with a fantastic store of human capital, use this capital, this human capital, to help a country in trouble. And everywhere, I mean, I remember being in Venezuela soon after that, whenever these doctors were mentioned, massive applause and cheers. This was very concrete. So these two attempts were defeated, and after these attempts, the third came with the referendum, recall referendum. It's interesting. Chavez and the Bolivarians had pushed through a constitution which gives people the right to recall their president. Just imagine if citizens here had that right. Just imagine it. You know, there'd be mega campaigns going on to recall a president in midterm. If that right existed in the US Constitution, you would have a permanent political campaign. Or in most parts of the world. The only other country which has it in a mild way is Switzerland. But Venezuela and the oligarchy opposed this constitution. They fought against it. Two-thirds of the population voted for it, actually voted for it. And the oligarchs then said, okay, we're going to use the right to recall. And they got signatures, but they got a lot of fake signatures, as we later found out. They went into banks, got the list of all the clients of banks, of big companies, employees, put their names down without even asking them. Chavez did the clever thing. He said, fine, let's not question these signatures. I know most of them are fake, or many of them are fake. Let's have the referendum. Let's go with it. What's the point? Then they'll say, oh, we've been robbed of a victory. They didn't recognize these signatures. So they had a referendum. And in order to make sure that no one doubted it, he opened up Venezuela to all international observers. Jimmy Carter went from here with his foundation. Lots of Americans went to observe these elections. And he won again. The fourth victory. And Carter said that these were Carter actually made quite an interesting statement. He said, these are the fairest elections I've ever seen in my life. And one assumes he was referring to this country, because he couldn't have seen too many others. So after that, the oligarchs went into a decline, became very demoralized, and this election coming up now in a few weeks' time, their plan was to boycott it. The plan was to boycott it so Chavez would be elected unopposed, and then they would say, ah, well, you see, we always told you he is an authoritarian. But the United States, for its own reasons, did not want him to be elected unopposed, and so told them they had to put up a candidate. So they have found a candidate and put him up. And a lot of money is being poured in to the opposition from the United States, etc. But I think the process is relatively stable now. The big problem there is that the state apparatus, I mean, you know, is still pretty full with people from the old regime. And the reason for that is that Venezuela is one of the few countries in the world where the class divide more or less mirrors a racial divide. I've never seen this so strongly in countries. And one of the big constant attacks on Chavez from the oligarchs were that he was a Zambo. Zambo, for those of you who don't know, is someone of mixed Indian, mixed indigenous and slave, black African slave blood, which he is. And the hostility, racial hostility, was quite frightening. But in Venezuela, you had the middle and upper middle classes are usually light-skinned and dominated and controlled virtually all sections of the state apparatus. So it's not easy to transform this till your own people are being educated and come up. But that is slowly now beginning to happen. And this change in Venezuela created a polarization in the whole continent. Lula's victory, one hoped, would join that, but it didn't, because here in Brazil they decided to go the opposite way and not challenge the IMF and the World Bank. And with the results that we see, that the PT as a political institution now has been totally corrupted from within, which is why Lula lost the first round. I think he will win the second round, but he got a shock when he lost. And the reason he lost was because when you go down that route, then don't be surprised when this happens. I mean, the finance minister of Brazil, Palazzi, former leftist from the 60s and 70s who masterminded this turn to the IMF is now facing charges of corruption and could be locked up. And the only way he could avoid going to prison is to be re-elected to parliament, because that gives you immunity. So he is being re-elected. Probably he will be re-elected. And I pointed out when I was in Brazil not so long ago that why is he so scared of going to prison? Because Brazil is the only country in the world which has one prison for the bulk of the population and another prison for university graduates. So, you know, they protect their own even on that level. But anyway, Brazil is a messy situation. It didn't happen. But then you began to see this polarization in the Andean region with the victory of Morales in Bolivia. Here, too, the pattern was not so dissimilar. It was a giant wave of social rebellions, especially the struggle against water privatizations in Cochabamba, which brought Evo Morales and the movement for socialism to power. There's no doubt about it. The fact that they defended these mobilizations, the fact that Venezuela had already taken place and happened, gave a mega push to this region. So Morales's victory was an enormous boost and began to give some shape to the concept of creating a Bolivarian federation in Latin America. The aim of this federation is to try and unite the region against the Washington consensus. That's the aim. And they are very clear on that, saying we can individually be targeted, picked out, and destroyed. If we unite ourselves, it becomes more difficult to do that. But of course, the United States, very extremely busy in the Middle East and Afghanistan, occupying those countries, has not mercifully had too much time to devote to how to deal with this new crisis they're confronting in Latin America. So what their supporters resort to, by and large, is rigging elections, which is the easier way to do it. I mean, that's what they've done in Mexico, which is a, you know, giant scandal. And if you compare Mexico, where the elections, according to every single serious observer, pro or anti Obrador, says they were rigged, they were stolen. The first recount they had, partial recount they had in the Mexican election, they discovered 2.5 million votes which had been lost. 2.5 million. Then later another million. So naturally the opposition said, let's have a total recount. That was the slogan, total recount, recount every vote. And this they refused. And they refused to allow Carter and his foundation to go in and observe these elections. They refused to allow any international observers in the Mexican elections. Does anyone within the globalized media networks complain? No. They don't complain because their side won. Whether the same is going to happen in Ecuador, we shall see. It wouldn't surprise me totally, because Ecuador is another country on the brink, as they see it. And Correa, the opposition candidate, has said that we will, if I am elected, one of the first things I will do is ask all U.S. troops to leave my country. And has publicly declared that he supports the changes taking place in Venezuela and Bolivia, and that Ecuador would join the Bolivarian Federation. They've said it in public. So it is becoming quite a serious problem now for the United States, but it's difficult to handle militarily. A, because they don't have the ability to do it. They are overstretched. And secondly, all these governments are coming to power through democratic means. So you can't say that what is going on in these countries is somehow bad, or they say it, of course, but it's difficult to carry on saying that when these people keep on being elected to power. So the only thing is to change the rules of the game and rig the elections. The danger with that, and they will find this out in Mexico sooner rather than later, I fear, is that because the regime has no real legitimacy, and because people begin to feel elections, what? You know, we go and vote, our people aren't elected because they rigged the elections, maybe we should try some other methods. I mean, that is traditionally how armed insurrections begin, is when people feel all other channels are closed. They never just begin, you know, that's the only way we're going to go. So in this polarized Latin America, we now have massive problems confronting the supporters of the Washington consensus. That is the situation. Why I call this book The Axis of Hope is because it's only in the Latin American continent that we see the development of an alternative social vision. It's true that in Iraq you have a mega resistance, which has virtually fought the United States Army to a standstill, as the Joint Chiefs will tell you. You know, Bush can say what he wants, but they know it's a very, very grim situation in Iraq. There is no way they can win, which is why any attack on Iran would be crazy and futile. And the Pentagon knows this fact very well, whatever the politicians may or may not think. Secondly, they've had a big disaster in Lebanon, which was very sort of partially reported on the US networks, but everyone knows that that's been a big setback there. I mean, certainly Israeli society is very aware of it. But despite all this, and these are not unimportant things, in terms of projecting a new social vision, this is not coming from the Middle East. They're resisting militarily, which is, you know, their right to do so, and they're resisting in Afghanistan, but they are incapable of coming up with a social vision, an alternative social vision to that of the United States, and that is a big weakness of all those movements. Because in order to have an impact inside the United States itself, which is absolutely critical from the point of view of taking politics forward, in order to do that, you have to have an alternative social vision, which is why Chavez's attempts to say that he's, you know, selling cheap heating oil to the underprivileged in the United States. Of course it's a propaganda measure, but it's not an unimportant one. That is why the big open offer from the Cubans and the Venezuelans to pour in aid to New Orleans had an impact. That is why when the Medical University of the Americas in Havana offers free education to Afro-American and Hispanic kids from the United States of America, it has an impact. It has such an impact that even Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State, insisted that the new sanctions against Cuba did not include those kids, U.S. kids, who were getting a free medical education in Cuba. He's very proud of it now, Colin Powell. He says, oh, that was me, because I realized that, you know, these kids would otherwise not get an education. So the links with the United States and the population of the United States become extremely important, which is why what goes on in Latin America is quite critical. Also, given now that there's a very large proportion of the population of the United States, which is Hispanic, which is beginning to worry some within the elites. I mean, Sam Huntington's latest effort has forgotten the Islamic enemy and the clash of civilizations, and is concentrating on this alien force within our midst, which is the Hispanic force, which is threatening, as he calls it, the traditional hegemony of our rulers, which, you know, is not the case at the moment, alas, but it's something that is worrying them. So you have linguistic links, you have cultural links between Latin America and large swathes of the U.S. population at the moment, and these links are not unimportant, which is why how the struggles are waged in Latin America, how they are projected, becomes quite critical for the United States. And that was really the point of writing the book, because within the media networks, that's the last point and then I'll end, you have had the most bizarre coverage of the Venezuelan situation you have seen. You know, not just in the United States, just so you don't think it's the U.S. press, which is on Venezuela, and I cite chapter and verse. If you look at the coverage in The Economist, if you look at the coverage in the Financial Times, if you look at the coverage in Le Monde, if you look at the coverage in El País, if you look at the coverage in the Sunday Times and Times in Britain, and compare that to the coverage in the New York Times, there's no difference at all. It's exactly the same line of argument which is being pushed through in these newspapers and television networks. And the line is that Chavez is an authoritarian dictator. That's the line. Well, how do you disprove this? The Venezuelans know he's been elected. Latin Americans know he's been elected several times. But people in this country have this particular vision of him. And I mean, the fact that he's having an impact in the United States is obvious. You know, he comes to the United Nations General Assembly, makes a speech where he denounces the president, you know, in language which I certainly wouldn't have used myself. But in any case, he does that, and then having done that, advises the citizens of the United States to read Noam Chomsky. He tells people to read Noam Chomsky, and within 3 days, Chomsky is number one on the Amazon bestseller list. And within a week, he's number five on the New York Times bestseller list, which indicates that Chavez's intervention did have an impact. And then they published, the New York Times published a piece saying, oh, but he said that he wished he'd met Chomsky when he was alive. Not true. Chavez was referring to John Kenneth Galbraith and saying, I wish I'd met Galbraith when he was alive because he would have been of some assistance to us. You know, probably right. So this, and then the interview he gives to Time magazine, and they say, you hate America. He says, no, I learn a lot from America. I learn a lot from Mark Twain. I learn a lot from the struggles of Martin Luther King. I know this country well. I don't agree with your government. So that way of intervening politically, of course, is extremely important. And that's the importance of the Latin American process, which is a transitional process. I don't know whether it will last, whether they'll win, but they've set their marker. And it's very interesting because in the 90s and the turn of the century, most people had given up and thought neoliberalism is here to stay. There's nothing we can do about it. Nothing can be done, including, you know, many good people who thought we just have to be hard-headed and realistic. Nothing is going on in the world, etc. Well, Latin America proved the complete opposite in terms of social political struggles breaking out. And the occupied countries proved the complete opposite in the sense that they said we will not be occupied without a resistance. So there are very different things going on. But the Latin American one, I think the Latin American turn is going to leave a lasting impact. A, because it's the backyard. B, because there are links with the United States. And C, if they succeed in transforming three or four Latin American countries and emerging and coming up with a federation, that will be a massive leap forward. And the most significant thing to have happened in Latin America since Bolivar led the struggle and got rid of the Spanish Empire.
Thanks very much, sir. Questions? Who'd like to begin?
They all, in different ways, asked one question. When will the Arab world produce a Chavez? Because they know that with the oil wealth they've got there, they could transform the entire Islamic world. They could transform it in educationally, culturally, if they had people of vision who wanted to do so. Not just the Arab world, the entire Islamic world, they have money to completely transform, but they don't do it because of who they are. So the Venezuelan example, from that point of view, has a big, big impact there. And it's very interesting that in the 500,000 people who demonstrated in Beirut some weeks ago after the war, the only foreign leader whose pictures were carried were those of Chavez. And when Nasrullah sent a public message and said, here from beleaguered Beirut, we thank our brother Chavez in Venezuela for the support he gave us, that is also very good for the people he's talking to. Because Chavez is not from that world. He's not a Muslim. He doesn't come to it. Because it also opens up the minds of people there who say, well, you know, this struggle is not just ours. It belongs to other people as well. Other people are helping us who are not Muslims. And that helps to open minds elsewhere. So that essentially is his international impact.
So I understand where you're coming from in you're sympathetic to these movements and you realize that the coverage here has been very biased. But on the other hand, I think the left in general has been very uncritical of Cuba for 40 years, one president, no political parties, you know, all the repression that goes on there. And I'm scared that they're doing the same thing in the beginning stages of this sort of thing in Venezuela. You have a humongous cult of personality around Chavez. People, well, I remember one episode, Alo Presidente, I was watching. That woman said, God bless the womb that gave birth to you. And Chavez said, oh, thank you, thank you. I mean, it's really gotten to that extreme point. And you have Chavez saying, only I can lead Venezuela. I want to stay in power till 2030. You know, that I am the one, like, the chosen person. And that's not socialism. That's not participatory democracy. That's one man. And you can say, okay, there was a mass movement against the IMF prior, but you really have one person monopolizing and trying to congeal all of it in his person. And it's really...
Okay, we got it.
That's my question.
Good. Okay. Okay. Well, look, there are two different questions you raised. You've tried to do something through a sleight of hand, which I refuse to accept, which is that the Venezuelan process is very different from the Cuban process. I mean, I've spent 1 hour talking about how Chavez is about to be re-elected for the sixth time.
You can be elected but not governed democratically.
You can be elected but not governed democratically. My normal experience is that when people operate like that, they're voted out of power. When they don't govern democratically, when they legalize torture, then they tend to be under some attack.
We hope.
We hope. But torture is banned in Venezuela. There are hardly any political prisoners there. You have an entire network of private newspapers, the big newspapers, who attack him every single day. The private television channels of Cisneros attack him every single day. And often they attack him by calling him, comparing him to a monkey because of the color of his skin, which would not be permitted in most parts of the world. So, you know, the picture you want to create is of no opposition. There's a mega opposition of the wealthy against him, who control the principal, who have a virtual monopoly of information. So, you know, this polarizes the country. When they see the guy they elect attacked like this, the poor also then defend him. That's the state. Of course, I think there is a weakness there, which is that it's extremely vital that the Bolivarian movement develops structures on every level of society so that if something happens to Chavez, I mean, no process should be so dependent on one person. We can all agree with that. Certainly not when Pat Robertson and other kooks in the Republican Party are calling publicly in the United States for him to be bumped off. So it's best not to be too dependent on one person, but one can't deny that occasionally, and especially in that continent, leaders are thrown up. You know, you have a long, long tradition of individuals who are thrown up by historical events who then play a very big role. You know, you can go back to Bolivar from that period on. So I think one has to just understand that about Venezuela. Cuba is a different story. Cuba is a country which made a revolution. It was immediately after this revolution, it was blockaded by the United States. The American intelligence agencies made numerous attempts to bump Fidel Castro off. They organized a Bay of Pigs invasion of that island, which was defeated. It's become a total obsession with U.S. administrations, this tiny island of 12 million people. The reaction of the Cubans was to cling to the coattails of the only other big power that existed at the time, which was the Soviet Union. And this, of course, warped and deformed the Cuban process. You know, I think many Cubans would now agree with that. In this book, I describe a visit to Havana I made last year, in which I had a meeting not unlike this one with in the Casa de las Americas in Havana with lots of intellectuals from that country and writers, and they asked me, what is your attitude to the Cuban Revolution? And I described it as follows. I said, for our generation of the 60s, we were in love with your revolution. Absolutely madly in love with it, because it was a very vital revolution, and we were linked to it because it wasn't a revolution which had come from being made by an orthodox political party. And then I said, for reasons you know and I know, betrayed us. I said it like that, and they said, how did we betray you? And I said, you went to bed with Leonid Brezhnev, a big, fat, ugly bureaucrat who influenced you. Who influenced you more than we did, and our influence on you and your influence on us declined. And then one person at this talk said, and now, I said, now you're old and we're old, so it's love in the time of cholera. And, you know, I think there's no doubt there've got to be changes in Cuba, and I always argue that these two countries should, Venezuela and Cuba, should learn from each other's strengths and weaknesses. And I think there have got to be changes. But if these changes mean Miami taking Havana, which is certainly the aim of this administration and its supporters, that will be a disaster for Cuba, which is why it's extremely important. And I'm very critical of them, to their face, by the way. I say these things in Havana. They have to change the way the press is organized. They have to change the way politics is organized. I say to them, how come you used to have such a vibrant press immediately after the revolution? I mean, Pensamiento Critico used to be one of the best journals in Latin America. All this went. You now have probably the dullest newspapers in the whole continent. And this has all got to change, because unless you have open discussions in your newspapers, you can't discuss the future of your own revolution. You need to do it. So these discussions are taking place. All the writers who were banned during the worst times, the hardcore Brezhnevite times in the late 70s, are now being reprinted, are being published, including people who hate them and have attacked them. So slowly this discussion is beginning to take place, and now there's an opportunity for them to push through certain reforms, political, social, economic, to prevent Miami from coming into Havana. Because I tell you, if that happens, all the gains they've made in terms of health and education will go. I mean, even their enemies admit that the Cuban health system and what they've done on that front is without compare. You know, there is virtually nothing else like it in what they're doing. And if that goes, it will be a big danger. And it'd be a tragedy if it went now when other parts of Latin America are coming up. And this is a question which does concern them.
What do you see the role of more moderate countries like Bachelet in Chile and Kirchner in Argentina, and we'll go ahead and include Lula? What would that have to do, or their relation with the Federation be? And I say that because of the comparison to Allende in Chile and the role that Castro played in Venezuela. He and Allende did not have that positive relation, and Castro didn't support Allende to that extent. So what do you see the type of relations between this Federation and other more moderate countries being, as being?
Listen, let me first disabuse you. The relationship between Allende and the Cuban leaders was incredibly close. They didn't agree with each other, but relations were really close. I mean, I don't want to read from this book, but precisely to explain the history of that continent, I've included in it stuff Allende said about the Cuban Revolution, how excited he was when he went there, the descriptions of Che, the discussions with Fidel. And he says that I didn't agree with their way of doing things, but in Fidel Castro I found one of the most intelligent political leaders our continent has produced. Allende says that, black and white. So don't get that wrong, that there were no links between them. There.
No, not no links, just that the Castro's feelings that Allende had towards Castro.
No, because the processes were different. But, I mean, I still remember when the Popular Unity won its election victory in Chile in 1970, the Cuban press went crazy with joy. It was the big headlines, the big stories. Allende visited, Castro visited. Don't get that wrong. It's looking at what happened then wearing the spectacles of today. And it wasn't like that. What they were very worried about, the Cubans, they knew a coup was coming, and they tried to warn him. But by the time preparations were made, it was too late, because a lot of mistakes had been made by our side in Chile. That was the tragedy of that. But in terms of relations with Cuba, they were very close. What has happened in Latin America subsequently to the sort of new Washington consensus is that many Latin American leaders followed that road. And the Chilean Socialist Party, I'm afraid, like socialist parties everywhere else, decided that they were not going to challenge the new order. So Bachelet herself is a very decent woman and someone one can sort of respect and like, but she is trapped in what her party and the Christian Democrats in Chile are up to. I mean, so much so that having publicly promised that in this polarized election to the UN Security Council that Chile would vote for Venezuela, under heavy pressure from the United States and the Christian Democrats internally, she's now said we'll have to abstain. So even on this tiny question, tiny in terms of what is involved, they find it very difficult to do something different. And that, I think, is a tragedy. Lula, I've discussed already, it's a big tragedy for Brazil. And one reason it's a tragedy is that these chances come to a country once every 30, 40 years. And if Lula doesn't do anything in his second term, which looks likely, then I think the right will come back to power in Brazil and it'll be 30 to 40 years before something erupts again, because that's how consciousness tends to develop. Kirchner is slightly different from Bachelet and Lula in the sense that because of the way in which Argentina imploded under for doing what the IMF World Bank had told them to do, they did everything to the letter, including pegging their currency to the dollar, and it imploded. And when it imploded, the people who came to power finally could actually use that implosion to get some gains. So in terms of, he got, I think he paid 30 cents on the dollar in terms of the debt back to the IMF, which wouldn't have been tolerated if Argentina hadn't imploded and if Venezuela and these places were still under their control. So Kirchner is slightly different from the other two, but also in terms of foreign policies, slightly better. But at least it's a continent where these debates are taking place, you know, which way to go, which way forward. Whereas in the rest of the continents of the world, these debates don't take place. And that includes, by the way, Europe and North America.
Back there. Yes.
Speak. Went, traveled all around the country on my own just in this past August, and a lot of patrolling there and whatnot. And I was wondering, is the government trying to negotiate the contracts with the big oil petroleum companies? And can they do that, kind of renegotiate the agreements?
Well, I think they can renegotiate them. I mean, it's their right to do it. After all, it's the oil is the property of the whole country. And they were historically... The deals which Venezuela made with the global oil corporations were always beneficial to the corporations. You know, if you look at the deal under Vicente Gomez's rule for 30 years, that the first 20 years of the deals he did with the oil companies, there are no statistics because they both looted the country's oil. You know, there are no records that were kept of it. So now it's something which they feel they can negotiate. And PDVSA has had in Bernard Momma, one of the sort of world's top experts on oil. It just is lucky that this guy, who is an oil economist of a very high quality, is a Venezuelan and actually has been advising the government on how to do these deals. And I think they will probably be able to pull it off, even though they are pretty isolated in OPEC now on the global scale.
If I can shift the conversation to Central America real quick, with the upcoming election in November and the symbolic influence that the Sandinistas had throughout the 80s, what kind of a moral victory would an Ortega win in Nicaragua be for the Bolivarian Revolution? And would it have any real impact in the shift in Central America?
Huh. Well, I think there's no doubt it would be a symbolic victory if Ortega were to win the Nicaraguan elections again. As to whether it would move beyond symbolism depends on what he is capable of doing and what he is able to do. But certainly, he personally and politically, he is sympathetic to the changes taking place. The only question is, given how discredited various factions of the Sandinistas became in the country after they lost, whether he will be able to do very much is an open question. But I think certainly it would mark a symbolic shift, and I don't think that Washington wants him to win.
Yes,
great. Stephen Nasu. I'd maybe perhaps like to shift the debate to South Africa, where I'm from. It's a long way off. I know that currently part of the issue is that, as I'm sure many people know, the African National Congress has come out under a lot of critique for increasingly detracting from its original social vision to more of a kind of neoliberal stance. And in terms of that, I just needed to get your views on the current succession dilemma that they're facing within the ANC. Who's our next leadership going to be? Who's our next president going to be? And are we facing a leadership crisis in terms of that? And if there's any lessons from the Latin American experience?
Well, there are examples from that experience. And, you know, when I was in Pretoria 2 years ago, I addressed quite a lot of senior figures from the ANC in some think tank and said, why don't you learn some things from Venezuela? And what is going on in Latin America? You don't have to lie down supine in face of the consensus. You don't need to do that, especially not South Africa, which is quite a developed economy. But I think it was too late for all that, because part of the deal in deconstructing and dismantling apartheid was that the economic system would remain untouched. That was the deal done by Mandela and Mbeki and others, and they've stuck to it quite loyally. Now, I've, you know, traveled around South Africa and visited all the townships. And in these townships, I talked to many activists, and they said things have not changed in terms of what should have happened and what had been promised. So the question then is, why aren't there any upheavals? And that's a question which many of my friends in South Africa, because they are so heavily immersed and involved in some of these social problems and struggles, don't totally see as an outsider can see them. And my reading of that is that the very fact that apartheid was dismantled, I mean, this, as you know better than me, this is a system which went very deep into the psyche of a people. And so you remove apartheid so that there are no stupid racist laws operating in the country, black people can travel anywhere, eat anywhere, all that sort of stuff, which seems trivial. That has had a mega impact on the country's psychology and its consciousness. And I think it will take another 5-10 years before they begin to feel that, yeah, we can actually do something now, that attacking our leadership doesn't automatically mean that we want to go back to the old system or give them succor. It will take about that time. But so that, I think, partially explains the passivity. It's not total passivity. It's they see the scale of the triumph in getting rid of apartheid. The big problem is that the political leaders of the ANC and the South African Communist Party, who negotiated the deal, I think gave too much away. And it's time to claw some of that back. Now, Mbeki is totally committed to this system. This is a guy, of course, you know, who never participated in the struggle itself, or any struggle, except the factional struggle which took place in London during all those years. So he is totally removed from. There are other people there, trade union leaders. Some have been bought off, as you know. Some of the best people have been given mega jobs in corporations, are making a lot of money, removed from politics. Others have not yet challenged the ANC leadership with an alternative vision. I know for a fact that the meeting between Chavez and Mbeki in Havana at the non-aligned summit was a very awkward meeting. I mean, they weren't even prepared to vote for Venezuela against Guatemala for the Security Council, even when they saw what the human rights violations was, because they weren't prepared to offend the United States. So this is a leadership which will not crack without mass pressure. That's my feeling. In order for something to change in South Africa, you will have to have pressure from below, which might give heart to people in the ANC who want to do something but feel powerless. Till that happens, I think the leadership will remain unchallenged. As to who's going to succeed Mbeki, there's no obvious candidate who's exactly like him. Zuma, who he's tried to discredit through various measures, not that he's a great figure himself, but now they can't totally stop him from going for it.
Yes, go ahead.
Just on this topic of Havana, do you see Chavez having any interest in the non-aligned countries movement as a political actor in the international scene? I mean, was that mostly a stint for getting votes for the UN, or does he really see that structure as something that he might use for operating, especially for his interest on the Middle East?
Well, I think myself that he has, you know, obviously he used it to try and get votes. There's no doubt about that. But I think he also talks a lot about that process. My own feeling is, I mean, I've discussed this with the Venezuelan leaders, not just Chavez, the foreign minister and others, is that you have to define in today's world what does non-alignment mean. Because this was something set up during the Cold War by India, Yugoslavia, and Ghana, to try and create a bloc of countries which were neither Washington nor Moscow, but spoke up for the interests of the Third World as such against both power blocs. That was the function of it. Today we don't have two power blocs, we have one power bloc. You know, you have essentially the Washington consensus. So it's not a question of being non-aligned, it's a question of being oppositional to that consensus. Who attends these meetings of the non-aligned? If you look at it, it's completely bizarre. India. Completely run by a neoliberal bureaucrat. He was a former World Bank, big economist in the World Bank, Manmohan Singh. I mean, you know, he was very sort of in awe seeing Fidel, said, I've met the great figure of the 20th century. It was awesome. But that's fine. But in terms of how India is constructed, nothing changes. Then who else did you have attending the non-aligned summit? General Musharraf from Pakistan. You know, on his way to Washington to promote his book and meet Bush. And you can just go through the list of all those countries that were there, and I think it's a useless thing, in my opinion, to be frank with you. I think we need some new bloc, but only after this one is done. The Cubans, of course, were very happy with it because it showed 60 or 70 heads of state landing in Havana, which they said on its own shows the United States you can't completely isolate us, which is fair enough. But it's, you know, using it for that is one thing, but imagining this bloc to come up with anything is useless. I mean, it's been a useless movement now for a long, long time. It's a bit like the Commonwealth, you know, former British colonies who meet together once a year and or once every 2 years.
For a couple quick questions about oil. One, Tarek, how would you evaluate the dependence of the revolutionary process on high oil prices? And to what extent could you speak about what might happen if oil prices went down, say, in a recession? Secondly, to what extent is the very powerful positive effect of high oil prices, what it allows Chavez and the regime to do for poor people, to what extent is it providing, on the other hand, a huge basis for corruption and undercutting thereby perhaps the vitality of the leadership of the revolution?
First, in terms of oil prices, there's absolutely no doubt that the rising oil prices as a result of the war in Iraq, largely, which has been utilized by the Venezuelan leadership to spend a lot of money on social projects. Absolutely no doubt at all. But Bernard Momma told me on one occasion that they have not spent all this money, that they have been very careful in how they've been spending money, and there's a very large war chest, as he puts it, precisely for the period when oil prices go down, so that there isn't a shock effect on the population. And that is quite reassuring. That's why I said earlier, to answering a question, that the Venezuelans are very lucky in having someone who understands the oil industry probably better than virtually anyone else in Bernard Momma. So they are perfectly well aware of that. As for the corruption, I have no doubt that it exists, Bob, and they are aware of it. And there are constant discussions about it, how to curb it, how to change it, and these go on. And there's no obvious solution except accountability from below, which we can come up with, that these people must be monitored. And that's linked to the point I made earlier about the long delay in changing both the quality and the character of the state bureaucracy. That is taking a long, long time. I don't want to sort of reveal too many a secret, but Venezuela has 7 consulates in the United States. They have a consul general and a deputy consul general in San Francisco. In Chicago, who is a sort of solid, with the regime, the consul general in San Francisco is quite hostile. I'm not sure about the New Orleans one. So it's a mixed situation. And this reflects what exists inside. I mean, the first 2 occasions I went to Venezuela, I was really struck by this, that orders would be given, agreed, cabinet would pass them, parliament would pass them, they would just not be implemented. They wouldn't be implemented. You would go a year later saying, what happened to that? Oh, it's still not been implemented. And, you know, he tries very hard to change this, but he can't be totally voluntaristic about it. That's the problem.
You finish?
Lubo, and a couple of years ago, you were speaking here at UCLA, and the question, of course, on most Americans' mind was, you know, is there something unique about this historical moment, this surge, this unfettered surge by the United States? And one of the things that you said was that what was unique was the lack of countervailing force in the world. And you identified, and as I recall, 3 major areas and said, keep your eye on them. Latin America, the Asian Triangle, and I think the 3rd was Europe, but I'm not sure. I've quoted you on that several times in the last 2 years as I've watched Latin America. I'd like you to step back from what you're talking about. You've already said the U.S. is quite nervous about what's happening in Latin America. But given what you said, that I think it was 2 years ago, how do you see the position of that Washington consensus of the U.S. in the global power play today, given the Latin American challenge and the rest of it, as well as not just the social movement upheaval, but the economic overextension, the fossil fuel dependency, the state of crisis of this neoliberal consensus?
Well, look, if you want to see the world globally, then you take the following countries who have within them, I think, 80% of 60% certainly of the world's population, the United States, India, let's say China, the United States, India, the European Union, Brazil, South Africa wouldn't count like that. I mean, 3 to 5 parts of the world, which together have more than 60% of the population and more than 60% of the GDP. If you look at these areas, the United States is not facing a challenge from these regions, okay? The European Union, which made a few noises during the Iraq war, is now firmly back on side. All the regimes in the European Union, the change in Germany, the 2 different presidential contenders in France, Britain, as you know, is a sort of virtual U.S. aircraft carrier in the North Sea. The Eastern European states are virtual satellite states of the United States. So by expanding Europe in this way, which the U.S. supported, they've made it a very weak political entity. And it is not in a position, I mean, economically it's a strong enough entity, but it's not going to challenge the United States politically. That's become very clear in recent years. China, as I said in reply to another question, the Far Eastern bloc is disunited, you know. And I think U.S. strategic policy will be to try and stop any attempts at economic unity in that region, because it would become very rapidly the strongest bloc in the world. China, Japan, the Korean Peninsula, Taiwan, etc., would make a very strong bloc. Which is why, incidentally, that the U.S. are obsessed, this administration, if you want, where there are strong discontinuities between the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, the one region you can see it very clearly is Korea. Because Clinton and Albright had done a deal with the dear leader. Albright went to Pyongyang and said, we will give money, lots of money, to you to try and dismantle your nuclear weapons. And they were prepared to push through a soft reunification. Not like Germany, but de facto. That the Bush administration really put a stop to. And I remember I couldn't work this one out, to be perfectly frank, and I was debating one of Donald Rumsfeld's advisors, Ruth Wedgwood, in Berlin, just as the Iraq war was starting, and we were discussing, you know, we had a big row in public, and in private I said, well, on a totally different subject, do you mind explaining why you broke with the Clinton administration on this aspect of policy? Because I said, I thought Korea was virtually a done deal. And she said, you're bloody right it was. And we had to stop it. Clinton, Albright were just crazy. I said, excuse me, how? And she said the following. She said, we're not worried about North Korea and their bomb. I mean, they're sort of pathetic. They can't do anything with it. But what we are worried about is the gleam in the eye of the South Korean military. Because they think about this bomb. And if we were to tolerate a unification, even a soft one, she said, there was no doubt that northern and southern military people would talk very, very soon. Because she said correctly here, she said the strong force in North Korea is not the party, it's the army. And she's absolutely right on that, by the way. So she said, if we permitted Korea to unite in however soft a way, the unified Korean Peninsula would have access to nuclear weapons. If the Korean Peninsula gets nuclear weapons, we cannot carry on denying the Japanese the right to have them. If you have a situation where China, Japan, and the Korean Peninsula has nuclear weapons, this shifts the relationship of strategic power away from the United States, and we're not going to tolerate that. Very clear-cut geopolitical view, and, you know, from that point of view, quite convincing, a bit crazy, because how long can you stop it for, but quite convincing. So they've stopped that process taking place there. They stop any attempts, serious attempts, between the Japanese and the Chinese to do business of any sort. They've kept Japan strongly. So the Far Eastern bloc is very weak politically. Then, of course, China is, you know, the new sort of 21st century model of Victorian England. Massive industrial revolution in process, massive development of capitalism, a very dynamic capitalism with all its downsides too, but a capitalism very heavily dependent on the American market. And that is the constraint on China. What they are more worried about, the Chinese, is not the United States. I mean, obviously they don't want the United States to destabilize them, and if the US does that, they will do something. But I think that's unlikely at the moment. But what the Chinese are mainly worried about is internal pressures inside China. So, you know, they constantly invite people to come. I mean, recently a former radical of the 60s, now a sort of historian at Cambridge, was invited in Britain, was invited to give a talk to the Politburo's top think tank. And the subject of his talk was, how did Britain avoid a revolution in the 19th century? Why? Because they see this gigantic working class emerging. They see, and we know, there have been peasant uprisings. And China is, you know, a country with that potential. And that is what worries them. So in terms of a challenge to the, and, you know, in terms of Brazil, as we've argued, they've kept that under control. So from all the key areas, they have not yet faced a threat. The threat, as I argued, comes from the oppositions in the Arab world in Afghanistan, which is a sort of really very defensive measures by these groups. They're not offensive, just to keep their countries independent. That's all, by and large, they're fighting for, except the Palestinians, who are fighting for a Palestinian state, which, in my opinion, is now a totally utopian notion. So apart from that, you get Latin America, which is why, you know, just to create some hope in the world again, it's extremely important, because that hope had gone out.
Yes.
Probably about an hour long on BBC trying to prove that Hugo Chavez is totally populist and he's very shallow in the way he impacted society. I wanted to ask you, what is he actually doing structurally, truly, on a daily basis? Something cannot be erased that is important on a social level.
It's what's very interesting that the word populism used to be a word which the left used to use to attack regimes which weren't staunchly based on the working class. Why this should be an abuse for anyone from the right of the establishment, I don't understand. But anyway, I'm not saying you're saying that. I'm saying,
no,
but
I was shocked that he was talking about Chavez.
He's
being merely a populist.
Merely a populist.
Yeah. But for some reason, this word has become an abuse word. Those people who use it don't have any understanding of it. They just think it sounds bad, but they don't even know why it sounds bad, and so they use it. I mean, the BBC's propaganda against on Venezuela. It's interesting, you see. Why would anyone in the BBC prior to Chavez have even discussed Venezuela? No. Why has this tiny country become such a focus of anger or inspiration or hope? That's the thing. I mean, if he's like what they say he is, then you shouldn't be worried, because he'll destroy himself soon enough. But they are extremely worried. Now, what is happening in Venezuela is uneven. But the social measures are creating a new social base for the regime. And the real question is, how long can you carry on doing that without challenging the economic power of the oligarchy, which is still quite strong? Chavez has been very effective. He has not gone on the offensive himself. He's waited till people hit him. Every time he's hit, he then moves forward. Coup d'etat takes place, and it fails. And he then cleans the entire top brass of the army, and not just the top brass. There's a real clean out of the army and a restructuring of the army, and in some parts of the country, the creations of popular militias who are armed by the state, because their big worry was they might be attacked through Colombia at some stage militarily. Then you have a situation which the strike takes place, and he does that to basically reorganize the educational and health system of the country. And then the Bolivarian circles and groups which are now meeting are quite large in parts of the country. Officially, though, they're not like a political party. And many people say that, well, this is a very good thing. Well, it is good in some ways, because they are very popular, but you do need political structures. You really do, in my opinion. Whatever you want to call them, if you don't want to call it a political party, because I think a lot of people are allergic to the Soviet model and that style of party building, and who can blame them? But you need to have some political structures from below to create a new movement which can survive if something happens at the top. And this is where they are slow. They don't totally know. There's a real shortage of what we used to call cadres in the old days of the Bolivarian process. A real, real shortage, and they are desperate on that front, which is why they're very keen to get help from the Cubans and whoever else in Latin America is prepared to help them. But they're aware of it. It's not an easy thing. It's not something you can go in and say, this is what you should do and it'll be solved. I don't have any real solutions, unless you live there. It's very difficult to work them out.
Richard Erkes, this is a speculative question. And it's based on stories I've read to take the opposite view of what's current, that not oil prices would be very low, but they would be very high. And in that instance, I've read that really the major source of supply in the case of significantly higher oil prices is the heavy oil reserves of Venezuela. Mm. If this scenario would come to pass, how would you see that affecting the process you described?
Well, I think, A, they would be speeded up, but B, and in a way even more importantly, which certainly Chavez understands very well that stuck on its own with however much oil they have is not enough, that this radical wave has to be spread elsewhere. And he's very open about that. And the oligarchs attack him nonstop for giving cheap oil to Bolivia, to other countries, and to Cuba especially, to other parts of Latin America. And he does use oil as a weapon. There's no doubt about it. He said our enemies have used it as a weapon before. We're using it to try and transform our continent. And I think that's where it will become quite a big deal, that he will then really be able to fund social changes in neighboring countries. That is something which worries all the supporters of the Washington Consensus nonstop. This is what they talk about. I think that is the route he would take to try and make sure that the structure is created of four or five countries at least, which can both keep the Cubans going after Fidel dies and also change Latin America.
My question is, in the United States, people against the war and pacifists are either marginalized or demonized. Do you think if Bashar Khan emerged today in the Muslim world, would he be accepted?
Would who? If who?
Bashar Khan, who is sometimes called the Frontier Gandhi.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, he was a figure very much of the 30s and 40s, the person you refer to. And if he emerged today in India, he certainly wouldn't be accepted. I mean, I think if Gandhi was reborn in India with all his weaknesses, he wouldn't be accepted. The world has moved on from the world they grew up in. And I think, in fact, you know, even I think that the leaders we need have to be of a different caliber, because the fight is a long one now. The British in India were based on a very narrow segment of the population, the ruling elite with whom they collaborated, so it was easy to topple them. But the way in which globalization is functioning now, it can go quite deep in a society. For instance, if you go to India today, the entire middle class, virtually the entire Indian middle class, is committed to the global system. So it goes much deeper than it went when the British were actually ruling India, because that only affected a tiny layer of the population. This is also the case to a certain extent in Latin American countries like Mexico, Brazil, the Venezuelan oligarchy, who feel that their interests lie with this system. So that makes them far more pro the Washington Consensus than when they were directly occupied some of these countries in Asia.
Yeah, go ahead. My name is Ryan Watson. I wanted to ask, you mentioned the linguistic and cultural links between the United States and a potential Bolivarian federation. How do you foresee those links being activated and supporting the federation in the future, and possible retaliation from the United States government to try and prevent that?
Charles Crittenden, mentioning the Zapatistas and how they fit into your picture, because they don't seem to be supporters of the Bolivarian Revolution. They seem to be going in a different path. I wonder about your response to that.
Okay, Brian?
If in the flux of your comments you can include some more about Ecuador, it would be helpful for all of us.
Tarek, you have the last word.
You know, I've spoken a lot about Venezuela and Cuba and the strengths and weaknesses of each. Can't repeat that. In terms of the linguistic cultural links, I meant not just with the Bolivarians, but with the whole of Latin America. And the point I was making was that, therefore, what happens in Latin America, different parts of Latin America, not just Venezuela, has an immediate impact amongst large swathes of the population here. I mean, yesterday in the mission in San Francisco, there's a giant mural painted of Chavez and Bush with, Chavez throttling him. So I'm just saying that it catches on. And would be very interesting to do an opinion poll within the Hispanic population to see what they thought of Chavez's speech at the UN General Assembly, because I bet you lots of people identified with that, not just Hispanics. So that's the only point about that. You know, there's no one-to-one relationship. It's just that if you have Latin American, let's say, social visionaries who think that we have potential supporters in the United States now, which has become much easier because you have lots of Spanish language channels in this country and newspapers and books. So it is something which, for instance, never existed in the past in terms of the countries that were occupied or continents that were taken. So it makes the links possible. As to how this can be realized is a much, much longer discussion. The Zapatistas, well, look, the Zapatistas are what I call moral warriors. You know, they believe in the force of morality and example. And that's very important, and what they did in Chiapas is fantastic. But where I don't agree with them is in abstaining from politics. That is what their theory basically boils down to, is an abstention from politics, like what is happening in Mexico now. It would have been tremendous. Whatever your disagreements with López Obrador, and I have many, but for the Zapatistas to come out and say it is important to defeat this corrupt state and this corrupt regime, and I think they should have done it, but they kept aloof. And they don't seem to have a real strategy for the transformation of Mexico. I mean, you know, it's great having big marches from one area to the other, but that is not enough to deal with the system. So though I have enormous respect for them, I think that politically they have not yet developed a strategy. And the Bolivarian process is embarrassing to them, because these are people who have said you have to take power if you're going to change the world. You cannot do it without taking power.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.